Hello, just a short note before we get to the podcast. Remember, we're in the middle of a special series on the Olympics. Our last couple of episodes have been about the Olympics, and today is no exception to that. But I wanted to remind you in particular that the middle of next week, yes, earlier than Podcast Friday, you'll be getting notification of a special episode that's timed to coincide with an event at the London Olympics. So tune in to your podcast earlier next week for this special event. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast.
From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute Podcast in Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I am your host, Tim Lightfoot, and thank you for taking the time and downloading us and listening. Every week we bring you interesting individuals in the world of sports medicine, and this week is no exception. We have with us Dr. Ed Coyle from the University of Texas with us. Welcome to the podcast this week, Ed.
Thank you, Dr. Lightfoot. Good to be here.
Well, we're so glad to have you, and it's quite an honor to be here. Let me tell the audience a little bit about you. We'll give a little bit of a bio here. Dr. Coyle has been a professor at the University of Texas for 30 years. He got his PhD at the University of Arizona and did a NIH postdoc fellowship at Washington University in St. Louis. He has published well over 100 papers, reviews, and book chapters in the area of sports medicine, and we're going to talk about some of those specific areas in a bit. He's a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine. He has been awarded the Citation Award, which is the highest honor from the American College of Sports Medicine. A large list of honors and keynote talks he's given, including he is the North American delegate on the Sports Nutrition Working Group for the International Olympic Committee. And probably maybe more importantly, you are the second New York guy named Ed that we've had on the podcast.
Ooh, let me guess. Is he from the Bronx?
Yes.
Would that be Dr. Ed Howley from the University of Tennessee?
Would be Ed Howley. So, you know, we've got two distinguished Eds that we've had on the podcast, and so we're just thrilled to have you on with us today.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So let's just start off with a simple question. We often want the audience to know, what made you passionate about what you're doing? What made you get into science, and especially the science of exercise physiology?
Well, I was a distance runner in high school and college, and I was gravitated towards science. And so when I heard that you can get a master's degree in exercise physiology, I said that was me. And so I went off to Ball State University and studied with Dave Costell.
Mm. Another one of the legends, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it really was my background in running and my curiosity as to, you know, what are the limiting factors in running performance, and that's what I'll be speaking about today.
Yeah. Yeah, and our topic today that we're going to talk about is about the marathon. Can someone run a sub-2-hour marathon? And you've written about that, and you spoke quite a bit about that. Actually, most of your work has been in the area of human performance over the years, and we'll delve into that. But let's just start off with that. I think that what the current world record is a little bit over 2 hours and 3 minutes. Can a human ever run less than 2 hours in the marathon?
Yes, the current world record is 2 hours, 3 minutes, and 38 seconds set by Patrick McCow in September of 2011 in the Berlin Marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at the progression, you know, how often and how much people break world records, you can get some prediction as to what a person can run. We like to model it physiologically.
Right.
And we predict that a person could run a marathon in 1 hour and 58 minutes eventually.
Eventually.
So 2 minutes faster than 2 hour marathon.
Wow.
Eventually. Yeah. How long that would be, you know, certainly that probably wouldn't be in my lifetime. You know, we're talking about projecting out 50 years, 100 years, 200 years from now of what is possible for mankind to accomplish.
Yeah. Now, world records in the marathon, though, they move pretty incrementally. I mean, when you knock, I think over the last 20 years, there's only been like 3 minutes knocked off the world record in total. something like
yes,
that.
That's
so,
right.
So we're talking about small changes. So to go from the current world record of 2 hours, 3 minutes, and 38 seconds to a 1:58, we're looking at a over 5 minute change. So that's going to take a while, as you said.
That could take a while unless you come across somebody who just has remarkable talent.
Right.
And you see a rapid drop in the world record. That certainly happened with, if we look at track and field, in the 100-meter, Usain Bolt came along,
mm-hmm.
and he lowered the world record quite a bit in the 100 meters. And, he's a different kind of athlete. He doesn't follow the mold of the typical 100-meter runner in that he's very tall. And typically, you think that very tall runners, can't start fast enough to really be world record holders in the 100. But he does. He has a good start.
Yeah. Say this discussion, I think, is very timely because when it's podcast, the Olympics will have just started. The marathon will be up in another week or so, and I know that there is great anticipation about the marathon this year because of all especially the Ethiopians and the Kenyans that are running. Do you expect to see some type of attempt at the world record, do you think, in the Olympics?
Not usually. Usually, The Olympic marathons are rather slow. It's more of a tactical race. And of course, in the past, the marathons have been held in places like Beijing and Athens, very, very hot, very humid conditions during the summer, mm-hmm. which make it really, impossible to set a world record. Although I must say, in the Beijing marathon, the winner, Sammy Wanjiru from Kenya, he ran 2 hours and 6 minutes in the heat of Beijing. And, that was incredible. That probably is the single best marathon performance given the circumstances. And Sammy Wanjiru he's also the world record holder for the half marathon. Mm. So we know he has the ability to run very fast. And, and he was expected to be the next world record holder. And if anybody was going to break 2 hours in the near future, it probably would have been him. But unfortunately, he died.
Yeah.
He had an accident and fell off a balcony, a two-story balcony, and died.
Yeah.
So, but his performance in Beijing and winning the gold medal at the Beijing Olympics was certainly remarkable.
Yeah, we've had some interesting conversations on the podcast and some of our blogs about especially his Beijing run and how it really changed the strategy for running the marathon because he just went, there was no pacing at the beginning. It was like he went out to just run them all into the ground at the beginning.
Right.
Yeah. So let's get back a little bit to some of your specialties has been looking at these factors that make athletes, elite athletes. You mentioned just a few minutes ago that, if the right athlete came along with the right combination of talents, what kind of factors are we looking for in someone that may break 2 hours in the marathon?
Yes, the combination of physiological talents that we look for is one, an athlete having a very high maximal oxygen uptake, a VO2 max.
Mm-hmm.
That's one variable. The second variable is being able to exercise at a very high percentage of that maximum. You can't run at maximum for the entire marathon. So, athletes compete at intensities of between 70 and 88% of their maximal ability.
Mm.
And the third, and one of the more interesting factors, is running economy.
Mm.
That is for that given level of oxygen consumption that you can maintain for a marathon.
Yeah.
The question becomes, how fast can you go? How economical or efficient can you be at converting your body's rate of oxygen consumption into an actual running speed?
Hmm.
And so that's very important. And we've had some good lessons from some top athletes in how much you can change running economy. It used to be believed that was, was not something you could change with years of training.
Mm-hmm.
But recent work with Paula Radcliffe has shown that she remarkably improved her running economy, and we've seen that Lance Armstrong, a bicyclist who's won the Tour de France several times, has also improved his bicycling efficiency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you did a lot of testing. I know you, I say a lot of testing. You did testing on Lance Armstrong back in the 90s, kind of when he was getting started. And I think, didn't you document that in some publications of yours, like over a nine-year period or something like that?
Yes, yes. We followed Lance over from his from age 21 through 28, and we monitored his maximal oxygen uptake, which didn't change very much, but what did change a lot was his cycling efficiency. Mm. It improved 8%, which is remarkable for somebody who's already a world-class athlete to go on and then improve their power output or how fast they can go by about 8% or about 1% per year is what we had seen in Lance. And that's also about the rate of improvement that Paula Radcliffe was showing. It's about 1% per year over a 12-year period.
Now, you had mentioned there were three factors that we were looking at, and you just mentioned with Armstrong and with Radcliffe, I think, as well, is that VO2 max didn't change much. Their economy went up. How about the other factor, the ability to exercise at a higher percentage of their max? Did that change in either of those athletes?
Yes. We didn't see a change much in Lance Armstrong, but we tested him in the early season when he wasn't doing his real hard training.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we really tested him at the right time to answer that question. Mm-hmm. But with Paula Radcliffe, it did. Paula Radcliffe, her percent VO2 max at lactate threshold went from on the order of 75% up to 88% of VO2 max, which
wow.
is remarkable.
Yeah.
So that's one of the highest percent VO2 maxes at lactate threshold or intensities that you can race for a marathon. 88% of VO2 max that you'll see recorded.
Yeah. Now you just for the benefit of our audience, you just used the term lactate threshold here and. And explain to the audience a little bit what that is and why we use that as kind of an indicator of the percentage that we can run at before we get tired.
Right. Well, we mentioned VO2 max sets the upper limit for how much oxygen your body can consume. But
yeah.
the question is, at what percent can you exercise at before you start fatiguing?
Mm.
A way that we measure fatigue is by how much lactic acid accumulates in the bloodstream. And we call that the blood lactate threshold.
Mm-hmm.
So, a normal athlete would be able to run a marathon at about 70% of their VO2 max, which would be about equal to their blood lactate threshold at 70% of VO2 max.
Mm-hmm.
Where athletes like Paula Radcliffe were able to exercise at 88% of VO2 max, that means that she didn't start building up lactic acid in the bloodstream until she was going at 88% intensity.
Hmm. And that was always something I heard that Frank Shorter had, an advantage he had, was that his VO2, his oxygen consumption wasn't that high, but he could really exercise at higher rates of that or at higher percentages of that max before he started to fatigue at a higher lactate threshold.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he was also very economical.
Yeah. So it's that those two factors that you've got to have the VO2 max, of course, but you also have to have those other two factors before you can be that elite athlete.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And when we predict, we predict what somebody could run for a marathon. When we say that they're able to run under 2 hours, what we're doing is we're trying to put together the combination of those three abilities. And for men, we're saying that if somebody has a VO2 max of 84 milliliters per kilogram per minute and they can exercise at 85% of VO2 max, what I'm saying is they can run a marathon while consuming a VO2, an oxygen consumption of 71 milliliters per kilogram per minute, which is remarkable,
mm-hmm.
obviously.
Yeah.
But then the question is, how economical can they be? Can they convert that rate of oxygen consumption into a very high running speed? And if you're very economical, you can, and that would power you through running a marathon faster than 2 hours.
Yeah, wow. Now, just for some standards, I think, for our audience, so you talked about these athletes would be able to maintain an oxygen consumption of about 71, what we call milliliters per kilogram per minute. The average VO2 max for a college-age student is, for male, what, 50?
It's about 40,
yeah,
45,
40.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
40 to 45 milliliters per kilogram per minute.
So these elite athletes are performing way above what is even average for such a long period of time.
Oh, yes. They're running 26 miles at a speed which the average college-age student, male, couldn't maintain for longer than probably about about 600 meters or about a minute and a half.
I think on one of our blogs, we actually challenge people to go out and try to run for 60 feet the same pace that an Olympic marathoner runs. And you find you just can't do that.
Yeah. So. It's incredible. It really is.
Yeah. It's amazing that they can keep that kind of activity going for that long. Now, are there other factors that would play into this? I know there are probably people listening to this and going, wait a minute, okay, so you're talking about kind of inborn traits. Is there a mental aspect to this? Do you have to have someone that not only has those three traits you talked about, but also has to have the mental drive to do this? Or?
Oh, yes. The person has to really be hungry and motivated, not just for the racing part, but, of course, you know, you develop these abilities through your hard and consistent training.
Yeah.
So that becomes a major factor.
So we've talked about the men so far. Have y'all done any work on prediction formulas for females?
We have, and we've used Paula Radcliffe essentially has broken the mold on that because she's progressed the world record in the marathon so much over the last the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
And the current world record for the women is 2 hours and 15 minutes that Paula set in the London Marathon in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And if we project out and say what's the highest VO2 max that a woman could have, a VO2 max somewhere about 75 for a woman, and then if she could run, what percent of VO2 max does she reach lactate threshold, it would be 88% of VO2 max,
because
mm-hmm. that's exactly what Paula Radcliffe has shown.
Right.
And that would mean that she can run a marathon at approximately 67 milliliters per kilogram per minute.
Mm-hmm.
And then if she were very economical, that would allow her to run a marathon in 2 hours and 4 minutes.
Wow. So we're looking at cutting off another, 11 minutes off the women's time?
Yes.
Wow.
Right. Or having essentially the women's ultimate record for the marathon being what the men currently are running right now.
Wow.
In the same general ballpark.
Yeah. Now, would you anticipate that as we get closer to these things, we'll also start to see records falling in things like the half marathon and the 10 kilometers? You would almost expect that as the times get better for the longer distances, you'd also see the times get much better for the shorter distances as well.
Yes, yes. There's no reason to believe that the shorter distances wouldn't also show improvements. And typically, it kind of works the other way around, that when the records drop at 10,000 meters, that after a number of years, those runners who were breaking the records in the 10,000 meters move up to the marathon.
Mm. And
a good example of that, the previous world record holder for the marathon was Haile Gebrselassie from Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
And he held the world record in the 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters. And he never ran a marathon when he was in his prime, when he was younger. I think you only run as far as you have to.
Yeah.
But if you can win in the shorter distance,
yeah.
You know, and set world records and all, you focus on those events.
Yeah.
But as Haile Gebrselassie aged, he moved up to the marathon and set the world record. And even though he was slightly injured during the race, he still set the record.
Mm.
So you kind of wonder what the record might have been if he were racing when he was at his prime, when he was setting his 10,000-meter records.
So we can really look at those shorter-distance races as kind of a bellwether for what's coming in the marathon somewhere down the pike, huh?
Coming in a marathon, exactly.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned some of your work a while ago with Lance Armstrong and looking at riding economy. I'd like to talk a little bit about an aspect of that. You kind of got involved in a little bit of controversy with those articles when they were published.
Well, Lance is very controversial. So
it's like working with a lightning rod at times, huh?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it was when I say controversial, I'm talking about from a scientific standpoint. There was a lot of, many people don't know how science kind of argues these things, but oftentimes they argue it in print. And so there were a variety of different articles that went back and forth on that topic, weren't there?
Well, there were just questions as to people had a hard time believing that he improved his efficiency that much.
Yeah.
You know, again, a person's either cycling efficiency or their running efficiency, running economy. You know, it's been believed that does not change much with training. It's something that you're born with, and you can't really improve it.
Yeah.
You know, but we had seen Armstrong improve his cycling efficiency 8%, and Paula Radcliffe, as I mentioned, improved her running economy 12%. You know, that was documented by Andy Jones in England.
Yeah.
And we're seeing now that there are forms of weight training programs and plyometric-type training that also have been shown to improve running economy.
Mm.
So I think whenever you publish something that goes against the conventional wisdom, it's open to discussion, which is a good, healthy process.
Yeah, but when you're in the middle of it, I mean, how does that affect you as a scientist and a person? Is it one of those things that you go, oh, geez, just something else to deal with today, or?
It really wasn't much to deal with.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, it was a couple of letters to the editor back and forth.
Yeah.
And all, but it really wasn't that, you know, that time-consuming or anything.
Yeah. When, I guess, to come back to the, I guess, the ceilings or the maximum performance ceilings, you're talking about and you've proposed that a man can run the marathon in about 1 hour and 58 minutes and a woman in about 2 hours and 4 minutes. When we reach those plateaus, will track and field become boring if we can no longer pursue world records?
I don't think so. You'll still have the competition of the athletes on the track.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but yes, I guess it'll be less drama as far as of seeing, you know, actually witnessing the limits of human performance.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what happens if sporting foundations allow performance enhancement. I mean, they're like, for example, they're allowing Oscar Pistorius to run in the Olympics this year, and there's been some really interesting data that suggests that. His carbon fiber blades may give him a mechanical advantage. And so it'd be interesting to see what happens if similar types of advances are allowed in sport in general.
Yes, yeah.
I guess I think the point what I was trying to think about was, are there other things that actually we might see come online that may help lower that record even more?
Well, in running events, you know, running is pretty pure as
yeah.
far as, you know, as far as mechanical aids.
Yeah.
You know, they're essentially running barefoot with spikes on. There's not a whole lot of technology that will at least that the athlete can put on, essentially,
right.
That will improve performance. You know, there's always the fear that athletes will be using some illegal type of drugs that might improve their muscles or cardiovascular system in a way that will improve their performance, and you know, so that's I think we'll continue to see testing being done to you know, to make sure athletes are competing in an honest way.
Yeah. Well, Ed, thank you so much for your time today. We are running short of time here on the podcast, and as we do with all of our guests, we like to give them a chance to give us a take-home message. What kind of take-home message would you have for the audience today?
Well, I think the take-home message is, you know, that to be a top athlete, you don't have to be superhuman. You don't have to be a genetic freak. You know, have some aspect of your physiology that is just unbelievable. What we've seen in Lance Armstrong, what we've seen in Paula Radcliffe, is that they don't have a weak link. All of the physiology is rather high. It's not superhuman. Mm-hmm. It's not freakish. And the aspects that they were low in or had room to improve before, namely their running economy and cycling efficiency, they improve with years of training. So the take-home message is with years of intense training, you can improve your weakest link, and you can accomplish great things as these athletes did in setting their world records.
Yeah. Great take-home message for the audience. And thank you so much for being with us today, Ed. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Good.
And I want to thank all of you for joining us today, for taking the time to download and listen. And as always, we have a T-shirt question from our producers here. And that the T-shirt question is, what physiological change in Lance Armstrong was seen by Dr. Coyle's team over the 90s that played a role in his performance? Be the first one to send us the correct answer to that question, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast T-shirts. And again, we're running short on our second edition T-shirt, so get that answer in quickly. Otherwise, like I said, we sure thank you for downloading us and listening, and we hope that you listen next week when we have another interesting individual in the world of sports medicine on the podcast. Until then, we hope you have an active and healthy week.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Cheryl Marek and Samantha Springer and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.